Hello everybody and welcome to Patriotic Weekly Review, episode number 310. And we are back tonight on Odyssey, DLive and Rumble. And we're back with none other than the amazing Morgoth of Morgoth's Review fame. And we'll be introducing him shortly. Now, before we do that, I'm going to tell you what I've got planned for the rest of the week. Earlier on in the week, I did a show with Patrick Slattery on Tuesday. I did a show with Tim Murdoch late on Monday evening. I was absolutely exhausted when I did that. I think it started about 10:30 in the evening. And I am more of a morning guy than I am a night owl. So I was a little bit wiped out from that. Then on Friday, I've got two shows, one with Dr. David Duke, a pre-recorded show on the landmark ruling by the Supreme Court in the UK about what is gender and the Troon parade that we had last weekend, Easter weekend, in fact. Instead of it being Easter bonnets, it was a Troon parade in London, and they had a little bit of a meltdown. So that was something interesting. And then Sunday night, I've been trying to get Ray from BitChute. He said he tentatively booked him in for a show. I can't get hold of him again. So if anyone can contact Ray from BitChute, Ray, you were meant to be coming on my show on Sunday. Show up, mate, and let's talk about the Online Safety Act. That would be good. Now, one other thing I forgot to say is, firstly, I hope you had a really good Easter. And secondly, happy St. George's Day. How did I forget that is St. George's Day? That's actually on the list of things we're going to be talking about anyway. Now, before we get into the show, if you appreciate my work, if you like what I do, if you want to support me, please consider leaving a donation, making a super chat, sending a contribution, a gift, whatever you want to call it. Please do that. Obviously, you can't do that anymore through Odyssey. You can only do it through Entropy. The Entropy link is in the chat. Please consider giving generously whatever you can afford, $3, $5, $10. Remember, that's my income. What you see donated on these shows, that's my income. If you support me and you want to keep supporting me and keep me doing these shows and all the other things I do, please consider making a donation. You can also donate via crypto. All the crypto links are in the description below. So if you like me and you want to donate via crypto, you can do that very, very easily. Monero, Ethereum, Bitcoin, whatever you want. And if you can't see the crypto that you want, you can write to me at mark@thefallofwesternman.com, which is also where you can write to me if you have any problems, any concerns, or you've got any feedback for me. People email me every day, and I usually get back to people next working day. So I work very hard to do that. So if you are interested in speaking to me, please get in touch via that method. Anyway, let's get straight into the show. That was a very, very quick roundup, under 3 minutes this time. And we're interviewing Morgoth tonight. He's the special guest. You all know him. You all love him. He is one of the most prominent British nationalist content creators. He's got an amazing Substack. He produces amazing videos. He appears on panels. I've been working with him for I don't know how long, probably the best part of a decade now. And it's something I've always really enjoyed doing, always really got on with him. Sadly, I've never met him, but we've always had a lot in common. It's one of those things that if we did have a little ethno village and we all lived next door to each other, I always imagine living next to Morgoth would be quite fun. Although we'd probably spend most of our time watching old 80s films and discussing things such as the importance of gardening and sowing our own vegetables, which is something Morgoth's been doing. We're talking about that before the show. So me and him have a lot in common in real life. Anyway, Morgoth, how have you been, my friend? What have you been up to? And let's get into this show.
Oh, very good, thanks. I've just been enjoying the weather. And as you say, I've become an avid gardener. The third season of gardening is here. And so now is the time to, you know, plant stuff, and there's always lots of stuff to be doing in the garden. The big thing this year is tomatoes, which has turned out to be a bit of a chore. And I carry plugging away on my Substack and doing the odd video here and there, and just sort of taking notes of the all the craziness that goes on, really. So thanks for having us back again.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure to have you here tonight. And let's start with some of the craziness. And one of the things I really wanted to center tonight's discussion on is the Online Safety Act, because the Online Safety Act is something that has affected us all and will affect us all. And look, before we do this, I just want a bit of a disclaimer. A lot of people sort of have waved this away and just said, Mark, just use a VPN. Use a VPN, Mark. Use a VPN. I don't think that's really the answer. I don't think we should be saying to people, use a VPN. We shouldn't be telling people that they have to purchase software and engage in a workaround. We shouldn't be in that p- position. Because the Online Safety Act affects us all, and there's a lot of people, a lot of dissident content creators, who've got large libraries which are now increasingly becoming unavailable in the UK. And this is something that's been coming for a long time. It's already taken down Gab, it's already taken down BitChute, it's already taken down the Hamster Forum of all things, and that was just a forum where hamster enthusiasts talked about their pets. But the legislation is so woolly, so wide-reaching, so grey around the edges that it makes compliancy almost impossible. So when you have legislation that is almost impossible to comply with properly to the full letter of the law, that means in a world where no one truly complies, it is the people who run the body in charge of compliance that get to choose who they pursue, which is very, very dangerous. And the woman who actually is in charge, she doesn't run Ofcom. The guy who runs Ofcom is one of the small hats. But the one who's in charge of the day-to-day operations at Ofcom is a woman who is a, and this is what they call her, a diversity and an inclusion champion. That's not what I've called her. It's what she's termed for her work. And I see this as a real step forward to the Ministry of Truth. And I'm going to throw this over to Morgoth, but before I do, I'm going to say one last thing. I think we all warned about this. Everyone's been warning about this for years. And I made a video explaining how this would work, what the effects would be years ago. And people seem to have just almost sleepwalked into this situation where everything's going to be monitored now by the state. How do you feel about this, mate?
Yeah, I mean, I knew about this years ago, and it kind of, I remember when I first heard the announcement, there was a bit of a shock, and it was like, they're not really going to go through with this. Like, this is crazy. And then it took ages. I think it had to go through second readings, and it kept getting rejected, and it got bounced around within Parliament, and then Lords. And it just seemed to hang in limbo. And then a few weeks ago, about a month ago, I'd kind of forgot about it myself, though it was lingering in the back of my mind. And then a few weeks ago, I was watching, I think it was the Lotus Eaters, and they had a little segment up that there was a fella who ran a forum, and it was nothing. It was about how to treat hamsters. Like, if you had hamsters as a pet. And he'd complained because he now had, and apparently he had like hundreds of people on this forum, but he could no longer, he was told by the Online Safety Act, by Ofcom, that he had to do all this regulation and all these compliance tests because he was holding a public forum. And he decided to just shut it up. He shut up shop. He couldn't carry it on. I think he tried to shift it to Facebook or something. And then there was another one where there was some cycling club from somewhere, and they had a forum, and they couldn't comply. And they were like, well, that's it. That's the end of it. We just don't have the time to go through all this regulation. We're just part-timers. It was just a Sunday cycling club. And it was strange because then, like, it was this kind of tremor out on the fringes, like far away from us. And you know, like the Borg approaching Federation space, where there's this like far off little station just goes silent, and you think, oh, that's odd. And then it begins to get closer and closer, and then before I knew it, I saw Gab was under attack, and then BitChute went down, and all of this kind of thing. And the real kind of horror about all this, a lot of people from different parts of the world, America and stuff, they'll comment on why are things so crazy? Why are things so dystopian in the United Kingdom? And one of the reasons is that we've got these Blairite quangos, which are quasi-independent, non-governmental organizations. Basically, they've got a kind of plausible deniability that it is just the government. They've got the pretense of being independent, which they aren't. And so they are given, it's government don't have to take direct responsibility for some of the most shocking things that we see because it gets outsourced to quangos. There was a similar one recently with that sentencing bill where white people were going to get longer jail terms. And with the online harms bill, that's an Ofcom itself, that's where it goes. And all you need to do is look at the history of Ofcom, the way they were going after GB News, the way, you know, there's these examples where there was a BLM act on Britain's Got Talent, and it had like, it offended a lot of people. It had like 50,000 complaints and nothing happened. But then when somebody says something about refugees or something on GB News, then there's 15 complaints, Ofcom comes after them. So this is what we're dealing with, and it's quite horrible. And I think the long-term effect of this is going to be where they're going to try and herd everybody on mainstream platforms. A platform like YouTube, I think the idea is that they just expect YouTube to do the censoring on their behalf. It's these independent ones. If you look at Odyssey is in the crosshairs here. I think Telegram is. I don't know. I think Substack maybe as well. It's a nightmare, to be honest. It's a nightmare. I cannot really dress this up. But this is a horror show. We're going to see Friends just disappear. There's people, for example, like Blackpilled, who posts on Odyssey. If Odyssey can't comply, you know, he streams on Odyssey. BitChute's already gone. And so if Odyssey can't comply or do not comply with the regulations, which we can get into about the fines and stuff, basically that means, as far as I'm aware, I just won't be able to watch Blackpilled's content anymore. Just to pick as an example. We're going to see like Friends and people who are in our network just disappear, just go. But from their perspective, it would be more like we are disappearing, I think. It'll be because they'll still be able to post on these places. It'll be more like Britain is going dark in terms of the internet. It's really deadly serious, this stuff. This is terrible.
One thing I was going to jump in there, but I let you finish, and it's just sort of a little point of order, is that I don't know if you remember this, but it was around the time when there was a lot of, one of the first times when there was a lot of discussion about the government bringing in what would essentially have been blasphemy laws for Islam. So obviously all the blasphemy laws were repealed, but the government at the time was attempting or sounding out the people about whether they should bring in blasphemy laws, which would stop people in the UK criticizing Islam. And at that time, the BBC screened a show called a production, should I say, it wasn't like an ongoing show, it was a one-off, called Jerry Springer the Opera. And at the time, that had the most complaints any TV show in the history of the UK had ever had. 47,000 complaints of people saying this is obscene, this is offensive, this has been produced not as an artistic endeavor, but simply to offend Christians and to demean, you know, the Bible, Jesus, the Christian God. And that was something that people look back on now. Oh, you know, silly white Christians getting so upset over, you know, their, you know, over a TV show. Couldn't they take a joke, etc., etc.? And Ofcom, I don't believe, unless I'm wrong, I don't believe Ofcom upheld that complaint. I think Ofcom sort of just slapped it to one side and said, look, you know, this was a comedy. There's no such thing as blasphemy laws. We're not going to be bringing back the blasphemy laws, forget it. But as Morgoth so rightly points out, you have somebody on GB News say something about migrants, and all of a sudden, two or three complaints, not 47,000 or anything like that, but two or three complaints, and Ofcom are investigating. And this tells you about the people working at Ofcom and how they will selectively decide who they go after. Now, the big problem is Twitter, Facebook, which also owns Instagram, and YouTube could have stopped this bill dead. Because if all of these platforms came forward and said, we're not complying, we're going to shut our services off to UK users until the government stops this anti-free speech garbage, that would have killed the Online Safety Act. It'd be dead in the water, because there would be no way any government would dare cut off Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube in one go. I don't think that's going to happen. And I think this is another sort of failing on Elon Musk's behalf, because I think Elon Musk will comply with this. He will absolutely comply with this. And he shouldn't be. And that leaves people like BitChute and Gab being the ones who have to fight the fight. But they're not run by the richest man on the planet. What do you think, Morgoth? Do you think people like Musk could have done more to stop this in its tracks and to show the UK government up? Did you think he would? And are you surprised by the fact that these American, you know, First Amendment companies are complying?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because a lot of them kind of got on board with Trump. They've changed their stance a bit. But if you go back a few years when this was all going through, back then when it was much more woke, everybody just went along with it. And I don't know what would happen now, but I do think that they want us onto the big platforms where they can do the censoring on behalf of Ofcom. But in this, so the big question here for me is Substack, because they have made a big song and dance about freedom of speech, which they've been pretty good on so far. And so I'll have to see how they deal with this, because they're going to have to conform to the regulations. The big one, I think, is as you say, it's Elon Musk and Twitter. Because really, he's going to look, if he backs down, how would it work? Is he going to start and remove certain people on behalf of the British government? Or because he's made a big song and dance about defending freedom of speech in the past and all of this. And if it was a few months ago, if it was the peak of the Trump election, I think he would have dug in. I think he would have went like, I'm not going to do. I mean, to be fair, he's already had people in the European Union saying, well, you know, freedom of speech might rule in America, but it's not going to rule in Europe. Like, one of the bureaucrats like literally came out and said that. And I think they're gearing up for a big showdown with Musk. And I had the impression that the way I thought this was going to happen was that Ofcom would pick off some of the, let's say, low-hanging fruit. I don't mean that in a disparaging way, to some of the independent platforms. They'd go after them quietly on the periphery. They'd tweak their policies. They'd probably game out how it went, what were the sticking points, and kind of gather their resources together for what they would think, what they know would be a big fight with Elon Musk over this. Whether or not he would comply or not, I don't know. Like I say, I think a few months ago, I think he would have fought them tooth and nail. But now I'm not so sure. I feel like he's had the wind knocked out of him a little bit. I think he's come too close to the candle. And he might actually buckle here. I don't know. I honestly don't know. But I think it will be a disaster for his platform if he does comply with it. I mean, he's a bigger problem for it, it's difficult to say, because so many things like geopolitically are shifting. And you get the sense that in a way, the kind of the European globalist types, they're on the back foot and they're losing on a lot of different fronts. And so it seems that they're already so popular. If you think of J.D. Vance calling them out for their free speech stances and all of this, they'd lose even more political capital if they then went to war over this. And in particular, the British government. But this, even though technically it's not the government, it is really. And I just think Britain's reputation is really in the toilet about freedom of speech, about how anti-white it is, where you've got really, like, literally the vice president calling this out. There was even talk where Trump and Vance were talking about kind of bundling in the Britain's free speech with the tariffs. So in other words, if you don't start giving your people more free speech, we're going to bump up the tariffs on Britain and put you in line with the rest of Europe, because we got off with 10%. And it's as if they talk to Keir Starmer, they talk to the Labour government and the British political class in general, as if they're a banana republic, as if it's like North Korea and they're persecuting and silencing their native population. Like, this is right out in the open, and yet amazingly, they don't seem to care. They carry on with it anyway. And so this is when it comes to Ofcom and how far they'll go. Will they take on Musk? Because it would have repercussions. It would be brought up at press conferences in the Oval Office and this kind of thing. But it's as if Keir Starmer in particular just doesn't care that across the world, Britain is seen as a basket case. So we'll have to wait and see.
You see, I'm inclined to agree with you. If this had been in campaigning time, I think Musk would have said, look, we're going to put our foot down. We're the free speech guys. And a lot of Americans would have supported that. However, Tesla is down 71% in terms of its worth on the stock market. It's absolutely crashing. It's in the toilet. His organization, which I believe is called, is it Doge, is not doing the things it said it was going to do. He's talking about stepping down. The friendship between him and Trump has degraded somewhat. Twitter is losing money. But when you're the richest man on the planet, do you have to make money on every single project that you're involved in? The answer is no. And I would think that more likely, if any site was going to fight the UK government, it would actually be Rumble. And it would be Rumble because JD Vance apparently has some kind of share in the platform. And because he has some kind of share in the platform, you are literally going up against Trump's deputy, aren't you? You're going up against the vice president. And at that point, there are political connotations to what you're doing. But if Vance and Musk work together with the power of both Rumble and Twitter, I think they could push forward. And I think you might even have maybe Facebook or Google join them. You see, the big issue here isn't just the censorship. And I know people in the chat are going to be, what are you talking about, Mark? It's all about the censorship. But it isn't just about the censorship. The censorship is just part of it. The other part of it is data sharing. You see, what this Online Safety Act does is compel any service in the UK, whether that's Google, Apple, Facebook, Instagram, whether it's Twitter, Odyssey, it doesn't matter. Any service, and it's not just services that are based in the UK, it's any service that can be reasonably used in the UK. So you could even say, look, that Chinese website could be used in the UK. So it's a Chinese language website, but it could be used in the UK. You know, we could all start streaming on it if we wanted to do our streams on a Chinese website to escape UK jurisdiction. Well, then it comes under UK jurisdiction. So the jurisdiction of this act is so far reaching that any site where any form of data can be shared, theoretically by someone in the UK, falls under the jurisdiction of Ofcom. So, you know, there could be a tiny little website operated out of a tiny little country with a comment section on, and as theoretically a UK user could sign into that site and post just a comment, and that's user generated content according to this act, that site then falls under the powers of Ofcom, and Ofcom can then block it from being seen in the UK if it doesn't comply. But what Ofcom can also do is not just censor those sites, but can compel those sites to hand over the data of any users. So if, say, a site like, and we'll use BitChute as an example, if BitChute had dug its heels in, the UK could have compelled BitChute in court to hand over the data, not just of the people producing content, but of the people watching that content, commenting on that content, liking that content. So if you were a user signed in and BitChute was keeping a record of who watched a video that the British government didn't want people to watch, the British government could then say to BitChute, look, we need to know who made the video and the names, addresses, and details of any UK users that watched it, commented on it, liked it, or shared it. And at that point, you're going further down this road of tyranny, because you're not just stopping people from seeing something, you are potentially prosecuting people who watched the wrong content, or at the very least, putting those people on a big database of thought criminals. And that goes hand in hand with what the police have been doing with these non-crime hate incidents, where people who commit acts which are not crimes but are motivated by hate. So let's say Morgoth is planting his tomatoes and he's having a bad day, and somebody down the street is driving down the street honking their horn, and Morgoth's had enough and he walks out onto the front of his street. He's having a bad day because the tomatoes are failing, and he looks down the street and he's like, will you stop with that honking of your horn, you're doing everyone's head in. Well, if the driver of the car honking his horn is black and perceives that Morgoth shouting at him was racially motivated and not motivated by anger over a failing tomato crop, Morgoth has just committed a non-crime hate incident. His name goes on a database. And let's say that database was then cross-checked with databases of names and addresses of people who watch the wrong content. All of a sudden, the government has a very, very powerful set of tools to identify people who are hearing the wrong message and then potentially acting totally legally, because you can tell somebody to stop honking the horn, that isn't a crime, but acting in a way that they believe is motivated by some kind of racial animosity. I think this is a frightening step forward. And I think the idea of the government, or these sort of Blairite quangos, as you term them, holding all this data on UK users, it's quite frankly terrifying, isn't it?
Yeah, and on the subject of Tony Blair, which relates to all of this, you'll notice that his digital ID scheme, after 20 years, it looks like it is actually coming now. So last year, Labour rejected that. They said, we're not interested in that. And then they've lost a few people mysteriously. There's some new people popped up. And now it seems that it's all systems go and the digital ID is actually coming. And I remember in the sort of around the COVID era, I was doing a lot of content, a lot of video essays on the nightmare scenario of digital IDs. And a lot of people didn't like it. A lot of people, and I feel like it was one of those issues where I was just too far ahead of the game. Not because I'm a genius or anything, but just because I'm inherently suspicious of technology. And to go back to the online harms bill, let's not forget, the official reason why it's being brought in is to protect kids from viewing all kinds of nasty business, on being taken advantage of, seeing porn, seeing things they shouldn't see. Fair enough. The first thing is, there's already laws in place to protect them, and it's also the responsibility of the parents. But what this leads to is a verification system. So you've got this kind of pretend, they've created this problem that children are viewing things they shouldn't be looking at online. Even though a lot of material is already illegal. But you see that the real thing they want is to have a digital verification system for everybody who goes on the internet. And you can now begin to see, aha, so that's actually in the online harms bill, that'll be coming as well. And then you can say, okay, I'm an adult, so I can prove my age, I can prove my identity. And then you're on. They've got you in that way. But then when you add in the digital ID, you'll use your digital ID to log on to the internet, to log on to your social media accounts. It'll send you a little password to your phone and all the rest of it. So this gets back to what you were saying, where what they're doing is building up a digital image of you, of all of us. In this system, and it's all based on data. It's all like billions and billions, trillions of dollars, and it's finally coming here. And the reason why I hate it, and I've always opposed it, is because the end result of it all is this kind of gamified society where there's something which I've long argued that it's something inherent within digital systems where they become gamified. So if you think of a video game like Skyrim, where you go down the tunnel and you kill the zombies and then you get the magic sword, you've unlocked an achievement, and then you go on to the next phase. And this is how I feel like society is already heading. A lot of it doesn't make any sense to me at all. I don't understand why a digital boarding pass is inherently better than a paper boarding pass. Because your phone, the battery in your phone can die, but the paper will still be there in your pocket in 10 years' time. So just in terms of being handy, it isn't like that. And everything is getting shifted onto these digital devices. And I had people saying to us, yeah, so where's the digital IDs? And I was like, yeah, maybe I got it wrong. And now I see that it's back. It's here again, just in time to link up with the online harms bill. And I'm reminded of that. I've used this analogy before, but that Star Wars thing, Andor, where he's taken to a gulag, the main character, and he's putting together pieces of something, and you don't know what it is. And then the camera pans out, and it's like all over this planet. You can see that they're all constructing different mechanical parts, but you don't know. Nobody knows what the finished result of it will be. And then the big reveal at the end is that it's actually they're all together, unknowingly putting the Death Star together. Like and you see the final plate going in. All they thought they were doing was putting in rivets and springs and whatnot. But when you zoom out, all of the parts begin to slot in with one another, and you've got this kind of nightmare super weapon. And that's exactly what all of these policies are heading towards. It's kind of strange because it's as if I'm reliving like 2022 or something, seeing it all come in.
Well, what I'll say about that, that bothers me about a digital ID is considering we are moving away from cash, which is a big problem in itself, and we're moving towards sort of, I'm not going to say a digital currency like a cryptocurrency, but card-only payments. And you do have restaurants like Pizza Hut now that are card-only payments. And banks are increasingly telling people, well, you can't take the money out in cash. You can't take out £5,000 in cash. We need to know what you're spending it on. And there's already monitoring of things like that. And if you have something like the Online Harms Act, Online Safety Act, and then you have these non-crime hate incidents, and there's databases being built up, and all of these are tied in with some kind of digital ID, which inevitably, and it is inevitable, that at some point would be connected with things like banking, the ability to spend money over a certain threshold. You could quite easily be out with your children in the supermarket. You go to pay for the shopping. We're sorry, but there has been a block put on your account. Why? Please contact your service provider. You ring up your service provider and they read you a generic statement such as, we are sorry to inform you that at the current time, there is a block placed on your account because you have exceeded the number of points under the whatever act because of material you have viewed and or things that you have said or done which contravene our safer society working framework. If you have any questions, you must submit them in writing. We don't have to answer any of your questions. Your account will be locked for a minimum of 30 days, at which point you blow up and say, give me my effing money. And they say, you have now committed a further offence. Your account will now be shut within 30 days. How do I get my money? You must open another account. Well, I can't open another account, can I? Because I can't deposit any money in it because you've got my money. I want it in cash. Sorry, we don't do cash withdrawals anymore. Da, 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 da. And that is a way to control people. And I think that is something we will be moving towards. It will also allow the government to see where people spend their money, where they go, where they frequent. And all of a sudden, you have this incredibly easy to produce digital map of people's movements, of what people are viewing, of what they're saying, And all of a sudden, you do gamify society. And I think the way they will do that, and I would argue, it's a bit, Skyrim is a good example, but I've never actually played that, strangely enough. I've played The Witcher 3, and I've played Fallout 3, and Fallout 3 is a fantastic game. But in Fallout 3, you're in a wasteland, and there's been a nuclear war. So you are sort of graded on whether you do good things or bad things. And if you do good things and you become a good guy, people in the wasteland treat you differently. So you can be Mark the hero who goes around saving cats and stopping raiders and giving people food and fresh water, and people will welcome you as you walk up to them. Or you can be Mark the bandit who goes around stealing people's food and nobbling the salesman and stealing people's wares and shaking down villages full of survivors. But if you do that, when you walk up to people in the wasteland, they will either run away from you, be hostile, or even try to kill you. And this is all done on a system of what they call, a karma system. So the more good you do, the better you'll be perceived in the world. The more bad you do, the worse you'll be perceived in the world. And I think that is what they will do. They'll bring in a series of social credits that will be tied to your digital ID and thus your ability to bank and spend money and operate in the real world. So that when you put your card in somewhere, they will say, it'll be like a traffic light system. Green, this guy's great. He agrees with the system. He campaigns for the right things. He believes in the right things. He watches the right things. Amber, this guy has done a few things that we find questionable. And that could even include, saying things like that you don't want any more immigration, or you can be red, at which point you're blocked from, spending money in certain establishments, or certain places can reject your business. All of a sudden, Tesco's doesn't have to serve you groceries anymore.
Yeah, it all points in the direction of a social credit system. All of it does. And this was even telegraphed on shows like Black Mirror, 6 or 7 years ago, when you had that woman, I forgot her name now, Bryce Dallas Howard or something, and she had to go to across America, and she had it was a kind of dark comedy, and at every step of the way she was doing it wrong. She kept losing points, and it completely wrecked her life, where she was destitute by the end of it. But one of the things about the digital ID, and this is another line which is coming out in the last couple of weeks, is the way they're going to bring it in is to say that they're going to be able to get on top of illegal immigration. So if you and what this means is, I think if you think about how they're going to approach this and the way they're going to pitch it, and I imagine they're going to pitch this to the likes of GB News, who will be tempted to say, yeah, okay, because we're sick and tired of the illegal immigration. And they go, to be fair, I saw one of the presenters, Patrick Christie, was pushing back against it. But you see, leaving aside, I don't think that'll work. I think they'll just dish out the digital IDs willy-nilly to all the illegals. But it is going to be an unpopular thing. It is going to be it is going to be arguments that people like us are going to have, because it runs against the intuition. But what it also says is that if somebody comes in on a robot dinghy from Afghanistan or wherever, and he's wandering around in the country, if everybody has a digital ID but he doesn't, he's going to be locked out of society. But if you turn that on its head, what's implicit within that is that if you don't have a digital ID, you'll be locked out of society, whether you're an illegal or not. So the idea is, well, the illegal, he won't be able to do anything. He won't be able to open a bank account, or he'll find it difficult to buy things in shops or whatever it happens to be. It'll be very difficult for him to interact with the government, all the rest of it. Or if he does, then they'll just give him a digital ID and that will be the pathway to being a legal citizen, I should think. But what's implied by that is that if you don't have one, then you're not a full member of society. And this all begins to get very dark very quickly. There is some people on the right who will go along with this. I've been arguing against this for years, and there's always been people pushing back who say things like, well, you're already being tracked now. You're already being surveyed by now. But that doesn't actually affect my behavior in any way. When the government is in, as you were outlining there, and all of the nudging, and the fact that this is going to be wrapped up with something like the Equalities Act, which is against me to begin with because I'm a white man, All of this is going to be baked into the system. So it is going to be expecting certain behavioural patterns from you, and it will be detecting them. And people like us on this stream, or people watching this stream, are going to be at the bottom of the barrel, like pretty much from the get-go.
Well, one thing I think you've touched on, which I wasn't even going to bring up, and we'll wrap this up in a couple of moments so we can get on to the St. George's Day debacle. But I've got to say this. I was actually shocked when they were saying, look, the way to reduce immigration. Now, I wasn't shocked they did this, but I was shocked by how many people supported it. When they said, look, we need to bring in, you know, a better system of sort of digital identification, because that could really help us with border control. And you sort of eyes roll, don't they? Because, you know, we live on this tiny island with a tiny border, which can only really be crossed, you know, easily. Via airports, which are very, very easy to control, or via the Channel Tunnel and southern border crossings. Now, I know there are other ways to sneak in, and I'm sure people do, but control of the southern border would probably stem at least the majority, if not the vast majority, of illegal immigration. And to suggest that the only way that can be done is with a series of digital IDs is pretty nauseating. But I can see the Conservatives using populist anti-immigration rhetoric to sell this kind of crap. Because if there is absolutely one thing for sure, it's the Conservatives never let a good crisis go to waste. And I think you and I talked about this with the pro-Palestinian demonstrations. You know, people look at pro-Palestinian demonstrations and they see three things. Firstly, lots of brown people on the street. They don't like it. Secondly, foreign flags on the street. They don't like it. Thirdly, people in headscarves and sort of weird dress that looks vaguely sort of Hollywood terroristy don't like it. At which point the government says, how about we bring in some new laws to stop this kind of thing going on? But the new laws are so far reaching and actually only end up affecting the people who protest against foreign demonstrations, at which point all of the good thinking people who voted for the legislation end up losing their rights. And I can see this happening again. It's almost like, I don't know if you ever feel like this, Morgoth. And I do want to talk a little bit about the failing democracy that we live under as well. But I think democracy is a complete sham. I don't think we're voting our way out of this mess. But one of the reasons we're not voting our way out of this mess is because dealing with the general public is like dealing with bloody Groundhog Day, isn't it? Every time the public fall into a trap, nationalists will say, they're never going to fall for that again, only to watch people fall for it all over again. You know, the trap is so obviously the same, but it's just sold in a slightly different manner.
Yeah, the digital IDs are a perfect example, because when Tony Blair tried to introduce it, I think it was in 2004, 2005, it was on the same excuses as well. It was on the state of getting under control, immigration under control. But it was too early, and it was wrongly rejected as being like anti-English. And at that time, it was only a plastic card that you'd have to carry around in your pocket. Like now, it's just thousands of people were saying, "Oh, what's this? What's this for a digital? What's this for a surveillance state? Are we living in 1984 now, where I've got to have a little plastic card in my pocket?" And that was just 20 years ago. But you see, in that time now, what people are quite prepared to put up with. Just astounds me. Just astounds me. It's as I say, the gullible sheep will just be nudged and prodded in a certain direction, and all these things will become normalized. The overreach now of this kind of technocratic managerialism would have just blew the mind of somebody in the 1990s. They'll pull all the little tricks out and they'll do it anyway and explain it all later. It's amazing that, you know, just the online harms bill, that they've just rammed it through anyway. If you go out onto the street, nobody will know what you're talking about, because they weren't on Gab. They weren't on BitChute. So, yeah, it's a horror show. I wish I could dress it up.
It is. And you've got to tie it, like I said, though, into democracy. And you wrote a very good article the other day about the sort of failing nature of democracy, the fact that people vote for things that they don't get, the futility of voting in people who then don't deliver or do. And do you know what I really, really hate about politics? A lot of things. But one of the things I really hate about politics are the terms about turn, U-turn, and about face. These terms are just bullshit terms. You see, when somebody does a U-turn, they have lied to you. So, but governments, they never lie. Politicians never lie, according to the media. They just do U-turns. So if a government is sworn in after winning an election that they won on the basis that they were going to stop mass immigration and on the basis that they were going to bring in a tough points-based immigration system. But then they do exactly the opposite and raise immigration numbers to the greatest they've ever been. That wasn't a lie. It was just a U-turn. Boris Johnson's U-turn on immigration. No, Boris Johnson is an absolute POS, total scum, somebody who should be never allowed near any form of public office again because he lied through his teeth and did the polar opposite of what he promised. But the Daily Mail, this crusader for immigration control, is paying Boris Johnson a small fortune to write articles every week because the whole system is so rotten, so wrapped up in lies, deceit, you know, so obsessed with backhanders, waving away people's misdemeanors and open crimes against the people, that you can have a situation where somebody lies to that degree and somebody goes against what is meant to be the opinions of Britain's sort of leading right-wing tabloid, but then Britain's leading right-wing tabloid employs him, gives him money to sell more crap to the people. This is fundamentally one of the greatest reasons why the system is broken. And I don't see that system collapsing under the weight of voters just being told to tick a different box. I think fundamentally what we will actually need to see before people drastically change their minds, sadly, is white people becoming a minority and there being a serious, serious fall off in quality of living. And I think then you will see a mass racial awakening of whites, and you will see whites being willing to actually do something more radical and take back a little bit of power. Because the fundamental problem is no one actually wants to do anything. People want somebody like Boris to ride in on a white horse and fix things for them. Or they want to cocoon themselves, read Daily Mail articles and convince themselves that there are people in the establishment who feel exactly the same way as they do about a problem when they don't.
Yeah. I mean, the gist of the article that I did, I call it the sadism of democracy, because I think if you take a step back and you just think the amount, the situation that we're in, just the bare bones of it, that we don't want to become a minority in our own country. We can just take that. And it's like, well, we never voted to get into this situation in the first place. You know, I remember the PA campaign where we were never asked, and with the date of like 2066 or whatever it was at the time. And it's like, it's true. We weren't asked. And this is supposed to be a democracy, and there's no accountability at all. People aren't held accountable for why this happened. But then on top of that, it's kind of like, because we live in a democracy, there's a plausible deniability by those in power, by the establishment. And people will say, well, actually, you did all vote for this. And I think, no, we didn't. But even just to park that to one side for a second, it's that time and time again, we're presented with existential problems. And the only way to get out of that is to vote. And so what ends up happening, you know, if unless you wanted to go down Crazysville, which, given the nature of the technocratic state we were just outlining there, is also going to be kind of...
Yeah, I just want to break in there. I'm not suggesting anyone goes and commits acts of violence. And I never say there is no political solution. There is always a political, peaceful solution. But that solution is just not going to the ballot box and voting. It's community-based action. That's, sorry, I wasn't saying that anyone should go and do anything crazy.
Yeah, and so it's the sort of sadistic nature of the situation that we find ourselves in. And what this leads to in turn, as a kind of knock-on effect of that, is that you then, everybody's obsessed with strategies and kind of formulating plans. And should you lean into reform where they'll be kind of a little bit more moderate, but they can get millions of views or millions of votes? Or should you be ideological purists and spend 15 years trying bringing people over to our position? And all of this kind of thing. And maybe it's all of those things at the same time. And so there's just this massive amount of energy deployed into sort of making the comet that's coming, diverting it to go the other way. And we never opted into this. And there's something so wrong about it. I mean, I mentioned in the article as well, but we never voted for the Ofcom online harms bill. I never voted to censor myself off the internet. But if we're lucky, Nigel Farage will become prime minister and he might do something about it if we just keep voting hard enough. But then again, he might not. And so it's a perfect example where you've got these horrific policies coming in which weren't voted for, but then you are kind of left to vote your way out of it and being desperate to do so, and all this energy conjuring up strategies to do so. And just as a general situation, it's kind of Kafkaesque. It's like the castle where he's just obsessed with trying to get entry into the castle, but he doesn't really know why, and he doesn't really know what the problem is. And it's this kind of weird Kafkaesque nightmare that we're in.
I think that's another problem, is when you're relying on people like the Conservatives or like Nigel Farage, or like anyone really. I mean, look, I'll give credit where credit's due. Okay, I'm not a big fan of Nick Griffin, and me and him don't like each other, but he did come up with a particularly good policy. He actually came up with a workable system of democracy. This was when he was at his best, before he is what he is now. But he came up with this workable system of democracy where people voted for MPs who gave them local representation, but major national issues were dealt with by citizens' referenda. So if something like the online harms bill was going to come through and then become the Online Safety Act, people would vote on major national changes, because that could actually be done pretty easily. And there aren't that many pieces of sweeping legislation passed each year for this to be something that isn't workable. In fact, most pieces of legislation could be put on a ballot that were held at the same time as the local elections, or maybe even you could have, you know, two days a year where you vote on these big issues. And that, to me, always seemed like a really good idea. And he actually called it direct democracy. And I think he said he built his ideas on, I think it was the Swiss model, because this is something they do in Switzerland. But it's very, very telling that the only time we've ever had that direct democracy was Brexit. And the government will never give it to us again, because it backfired upon them, because people didn't vote the way they want. So what you have is people voting for people that they think are the lesser of several evils, then praying that that person will actually do something they like. And it's so bad now that if you actually get something good, no matter how small it is, you rejoice. So in the end, all you end up being is a group of domesticated dogs sat under your master's table, licking your master's hands for the most pathetic number of crumbs that are occasionally swept roughly in your direction. That is the reality of democracy, and it's why I don't think we as nationalists should be endorsing it.
And the flip side of it as well is that because I know that people will say, oh, well, you just have to disconnect and just do your own thing. Now, there's a problem with that. And it's that what that means is, morally speaking, you are turning a blind eye to all kind of horrors. You know, even if you just wanted, just to pick one story where there was an old man and he had his eyes gouged out by his own walking stick and some immigrant did it or something. It's just like his daily churn of horror stories. And I find it difficult to be aloof from that, just like morally speaking, just to say, oh, well, it's not my problem anymore. I'm just going to switch it all off. I'm just going to push it out of my mind. I don't like that. I don't think that's right either. But your only course of action, as it stands, is democracy. So you're trapped in this kind of limbo where you kind of have to engage with it, because if you want to change, you have to come up with some kind of strategy or game plan, because you can't just turn away from this kind of rising tide of barbarism in the country, which I think a lot of people do kind of feel that now. I think that is kicking in quite a bit now.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I'd agree with that. But look, there is one last thing I want to talk about before we move on to questions. Remember, we're coming to the second hour show. If you'd like to super chat, if you'd like to support my work, please consider doing so. The link is in the chat, whether you're watching on Rumble or whether you're watching on Odyssey. The only way you can help me out now is through Entropy. Please consider doing so. Please consider making a donation if you support my work. But the last thing I want to talk about is St. George's Day. So obviously I said earlier, and I'm going to say again, happy St. George's Day. This is the day not just for England, but for the English people. And Morgoth, I've noticed a real change this year in the way the establishment are promoting St. George's Day. So for many years, and this was BNP was hot on, because St. George's Day was something that was absolutely maligned by the establishment for many years. And the BNP sort of took up the mantle of being the defenders and promoters of St. George's Day, because obviously you had St. Andrew's Day, you had St. Patrick's Day, you had St. David's Day, and you had big celebrations on those days, especially St. Patrick's Day. You know, when it comes to St. Patrick's Day, you'd see people all over with, you know, four-leaf clovers, silly green hats, you know, crazy wigs that made them look like leprechauns, and they'd all be out drinking Guinness and falling all over the place, and everyone was, oh, happy St. Patrick's Day. But St. George's Day was a little bit of a taboo. You couldn't really say that you were proud to be English, and saying anything good about the English was always seen as a big, big negative. And the Labour government at the time, when I was in the BNP, which is obviously between 2000 and 2010, which was 10 years of Labour rule, were very, very much against promoting it in any way. But 15 years on, I've noticed that the establishment have taken a different approach to St. George's Day. And we've seen people now like Sadiq Khan, Rishi Sunak and others wishing everyone happy St. George's Day. But the sting in the tail being that these people are proclaiming their Englishness. So at one point, Englishness was essentially a dirty term, a dirty word. It was something that the establishment wanted to ban the promotion of. But now Englishness is sort of being pushed on the basis that people like Rishi Sunak are the model Englishmen. And it's something I take real umbrage with, because, look, I'm a pragmatic person and I understand that Rishi Sunak can achieve being British, because Britain is an amalgamation of nations. It's not an ethnicity. Being British is being a citizen. And there are indigenous Brits, as in white Britons, but other people have come here and they can hold a passport. So that makes them British in a certain way. It doesn't make them indigenous. It doesn't mean that they are ethnically British, but it does give them a certain claim to being British. But no one can claim to be English unless they are ethnically English. Just like I couldn't claim to be a Scotsman. I could move to Scotland, I could live in Scotland for the rest of my life, but I could never be a Scotsman. It's as simple as that. I just couldn't be one because I'm not. I'm English. And I've noticed that there is increasingly this shift away from British citizenship identity which was being pushed by the Labour government, to now this idea that Englishness itself can be co-opted and changed by ethnic minorities. And I think that, well, for me personally, is a much, much more dangerous idea than the idea of British citizenship, because obviously the British Isles have changed over time. The countries that make up the British Isles have changed over time. At one point, Southern Ireland was under British control. It isn't anymore. One day, Scotland or Northern Ireland might choose to leave the Union. But one thing that will never change is what it is to be an Englishman, a Welshman, or a Scotsman. And this new idea by the establishment that Englishness can be taken and multiculturalized, I personally think that is one of the biggest insults that could be thrown our way. Now, I'm not saying Rishi Sunak doesn't love England. You know, he might love England. You know, in the same way that I could go to a country overseas and love that country. But I might go to Japan and love it, but I'll never be Japanese. And I do think this is a new attempt by the system to subvert Englishness. They realised they weren't going to be able to ban it and hold it down. Now they're trying to take it over. What do you think, Morgoth? Yeah. I mean, I did a post about this earlier.
Yeah, I think when if you go back to, like, say, 2005 that you were mentioning, or 2010, or around that era, and you had that, was it Emily Thornberry type of Labour, where she just hated the idea of an English flag and the white van man and all the rest of it. But there is a problem for the system if the majority population's identity is left kind of out in the gutter somewhere. It's saying kind of off limits. And so what they've decided to do, because we're heading into this post-woke era as well, where you're going to have more of a centrist, more pragmatic approach. Again, the Blairite influence, I would say. And so what they're doing is wearing the English identity as a kind of skin suit. And so I saw Sadiq Khan's post, and it was like, you know, this just sort of generic PR globalist talking points about democracy, tolerance, fairness, that we can queue up, and this kind of thing. And I posted a picture of, like, Kenneth Branagh and Henry V, where he was delivering the famous St. Crispin's Day speech. And it was the idea that, like, you know, he held a sword aloft and he was talking about a minority white London and tolerance diversity and spicy slop food and rape gangs and all the rest of it. It's just utter ludicrous rubbish, and it all falls into that aesthetic now that you see, which is like UK, like YOOKAY, which is, it's as if the country has been terraformed and a new thing is there with new signs and new symbols, and so the English one is being co-opted rather than lingering around as this kind of dangerous reactionary force. They will just co-opt it and astroturf it and change it into what they deem to be kind of neutral and safe and fit. That's what they're doing. And in fact, Keir Starmer said exactly that on his tweet about it, where you get this kind of surprising sort of patriotic stance from him about, you know, England and St. George and all of this. But then there's this kind of, and we all know the dangers of ethno-nationalism, and we all know the dangers of rejecting people based on their skin colour and all the rest of it. So it's there. So on the one hand, it's like, yeah, we're all in this together, but, you know, we're going to have, don't be on any misconceptions. This is like a civic nationalist. Okay, it's not about ethno-nationalism or ethnic identity at all. It's just our astroturf thing, but you are welcome to come along to it.
I would say as well, this is kind of linked in with the football, because I know you're not a great football enjoyer, but I have noticed that over the years, they have tried to make England sort of synonymous with the multicultural football team. So the big thing for England supporters, who are always sort of castigated as the most racist in the world, or one of the most racist sets of fans in the world, has been that if you're a true Englishman and you're a true fan and lover of your country, you must love the football team, and the football team is a reflection of a modern England. So to love the football team, you have to love multiculturalism. Ergo, when you put it all into, you know, one nice little parcel, you can only be truly English if you love multicultural England. And I found it actually quite refreshing. I think it was Suella Braverman who came out and actually admitted, look, she said, I can't be English. And I was like, well, that's wonderful that you're saying this. And she was shouted down, actually, by a number of people when she came out and said, look, I will not ethnically be English, but I am a British citizen. I love Britain. I love England, but I can't be ethnically English. And I was quite refreshed when she said that. And she's someone who, to her credit, does say the odd sensible thing. But that doesn't necessarily mean I want to, you know, ruling my country, or I wouldn't vote for her, but she does say the odd sensible thing. But I do think this is quite a dangerous precedent. But the way I'll wrap this up is throwing one last thing to you. This is the model they used in Scotland, because the Scottish National Party, which is essentially branded as Scotland's nationalist organisation, although it's not in any way ethno-nationalist, it's just anti-British, it's based around Scottish independence. They are a party that on the surface seem nationalistic, but are in fact multicultural and believe that anyone living in Scotland has the right to call themselves Scottish. Now, I think that approach has worked very well to multiculturalize and essentially co-opt Scottish nationalism and turn Scottish nationalism actually into the enemy of the Scottish people. And I think the powers that be have looked at what's happened in Scotland and are now saying, hey, why don't we do the same? Why, instead of trying to put our boot on their heads and being openly their enemy, let's co-opt English nationalism,
yeah,
and make it something that's fundamentally the enemy of the English, so they embrace their own destruction.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's exactly it. Particularly in the post-Southport riot era, where I think maybe in some think tank or some intelligence dungeon somewhere, they began to realise what we were talking about, where the English identity was sort of ostracised and left out. This is going to give you outcomes like what happened with the Southport, where these people feel totally maligned, they're not being heard, they're not being listened to, and so that what they're being given instead is a kind of synthetic public relations version of their identity that they can buy into. I think that's the gambit, yeah.
Well, it's nice to know we are on the same page there. So let's do these super chats. We've had some very generous super chats tonight. Thank you if you super chatted already. There's still an hour to go if you want to super chat. And we'll be answering these questions tonight. Ruins in a Landscape gave $10. Thank you so much, my friend. And he said, donation. Well, thank you very much. 100% Realizer gave $30 and said, tip. Well, thank you very much. Odgier gave $20 and said, Merche O Crev. I don't even know what that means. And if I've committed a hate crime by saying it, I apologize and take that back. I don't know what it means, but it's in French. Musket Basket gave $20. Thank you so much. Now, this is an interesting question for you, Morgoth. He said, the news about the split in the Reform Party is interesting. It's similar to the right being split between the Sansei Party and the Nihon Husu Party over here. Tories losing their long-held majority for being useless has also happened here. LDP is our equivalent. Similar script for white and yellow island vassal states. This is one of our Japanese supporters. What do you think about the split in Reform? Because I just want to... I don't know if I've had your say on this, Morgoth, and if I have, I apologise for not remembering it, but I do a lot of shows with a lot of different people. And I'll say this. I was actually quite enthusiastic about Reform, not because I thought they would be good leaders, not because I trust Nigel Farage, and not because I want them governing Britain in the long term, but I was enthusiastic about Reform because I believed they had the power and the momentum to take a serious number of Conservative Party votes, essentially destroying our old enemy, the Conservatives, levelling the political landscape and bringing about a new era where people voted outside of the traditional two-party system. So I didn't really want to endorse them as a party for their policies, but more as a wrecking ball to destroy something which has always been a blockade to real nationalism, which is, of course, the likes of Boris Johnson, Rishi Sunak, etc., etc., etc. You know, Thatcher being the perfect example. She destroyed the National Front and was a blockade to them coming to power. But this sort of split now between, you know, there's Ben Habib and Rupert Lowe, and Ben Habib has already started his own party called the Integrity Party, and Farage clings on, and he's still the leader of Reform, which has about 250,000 members, which is phenomenal. But I was actually quite disappointed that they've split so early before they've dealt more of a death blow to the Conservatives. What's your take on all this?
Yeah, I mean, I think they still might do a lot of damage to the Conservatives. The problem is, and this is where the Rupert Lowe split comes, is that if you're going to get rid of Rupert Lowe, they've got rid of lots of people, but let's just stick with the Rupert Lowe situation. I think what Rupert Lowe kind of symbolised is that we're in a kind of post-Tory right wing, where he is saying things which no Tory would ever say. He's basically coming out with ethno-nationalist talking points, or as close as you can get. And so what this says to us is that, okay, this is getting pretty serious. This is so much better than the Tory party. And then for Farage, he begins to get, well, depending on what your take is, if you go, I think he doesn't like the competition, and I also think he thought he was getting outshone, but in a little bit closer to his, in his favour, if he's going to go on Question Time with a panel who don't like him anyway, and then he has to kind of answer some of the things that Rupert Lowe brought up, I think that makes him nervous. Because he's right on the threshold then. He's being dragged further to the right than what he's comfortable with. It's all very well if he's going to talk about how Sharia law is not compliant with British law and all of this kind of thing. It's quite something else when Rupert Lowe is like basically saying black people can't be English, or that when they came to the grooming gangs, again, this is him, this is what he said, so I'm not endorsing this one way or the other for, you know, for the sake of the government there. But he was saying that he would deport or jail all of the grooming gang members, and then all of their families would be deported as well. And all of the people who covered it up would be. So in the end, you're talking.
He did backpedal on that. He said that foreign nationals who were part of grooming gangs, right, or the families of foreign nationals would be deported. Apparently, he did backpedal and he didn't say that British citizens and their families would be deported, just those who were foreign nationals that were involved, or family members of groomers who were foreign nationals would go with them. So it was deporting foreign nationals and or foreign nationals who were family members. It wasn't about deporting, sadly, British citizens or confiscating passports.
Sadly. But you get to the line where you think, okay, but he's our guy. So a lot of people on the proper right wing are saying, yeah, he's our guy, and then you see him just get bumped off like that, and in such a kind of dirty, kind of, you know, unpleasant way that Farage went about it all. And it leaves everybody then thinking, and then, I mean, Matthew Goodwin would come out and saying, we're still all you've got, basically. And I was like, yeah, but I think you misunderstand, because the problem is, firstly, the actual Tory fella, Jenrick, he's coming out and saying some quite base things as well. So sooner or later, they're going to bump off Kemi B, and they're going to bring him in, and we're going to be back on the treadmill again. It's going to be Boris 2.0, where you get all of but the Tories will be back to full strength. And they're going to say all of these things that everybody wants to hear, and then when they get in, they're going to just stab us all in the back again. And this is the problem for Reform, though, because then they are now to the left of the Tories, and you could even argue to the left of Labour. I mean, Labour are coming out now at the end of the year. They're going to release these statistics on the nationalities of the prison population and say who's doing what crimes per nationality. You see all of the James O'Brien types are just apoplectic with it. I mean, that's a funny story in itself. If we're all the same and nobody commits any more crimes than anybody else, why is all the DJs on LBC panicking about having these statistics released? But anyway, so I think that's kind of what the wound was for reform, was that, look, they've got a Muslim chairman there. You've got Farage on being recorded saying we're just going to have to accept the situation with Muslims or we lose in the long run. There's a lot of bum beats being hit by Farage. And then on top of that, he gets rid of somebody like Rupert Lowe. And what Matthew Goodwin needs to understand is that the energy dries up because you just look like Tories. And that's just taking us back to where we were.
I said something similar to this. I did a big stream on Lowe versus Farage. And I said the following, which I think we're pretty much on the same page. Tell me if we're not. But this schism will only benefit the Conservatives. Because when people vote for an outsider party, they tend to do it tentatively. They tend to see their vote as being almost the property of either Labour or the Conservatives. And they tend to think, well, if I lend my vote to this outsider party, let's see how they do it. And they do it tentatively. And if that outsider party then fractures or lets them down, they feel very, very burnt. And they run screaming, open-armed back to, either Labour or the Conservatives, sort of with their tail between their legs and thinking that's, you know, we shouldn't have voted outside the big two in the first place. These are a disgrace. They've let us down. I'm so disappointed. And when you've got Jenrick and Badenoch both making seriously based statements, you know, one of them's talking about two-tier justice. The other's saying that, Labour and the establishment need to apologise to women because of all this trans nonsense. All of these things are big, big flags to the, you know, middle Englanders that have been voting reform. And if reform blow it and reform let everybody down, I can tell you now that people will run open-armed back to the establishment. And my big fear was that all this split will do is it's not going to create a bigger positive ethno-nationalist party. All it's going to do is demoralize and undermine what reform was, sweep its momentum away, and people will go back, cap in hand, to a revitalized Conservative Party with a based black lady and, you know, the Tory version of Starmer, because obviously Jenrick is married to a Jewish lady. And they will run back because they're hearing the right things. Yeah, a woman's a woman. I mean, the fact that we're celebrating that a politician will admit that a woman's a woman tells you how bad the situation is. You know, it tells you how far we've gone down this road. And when Badenoch is getting, you know, she's on the front page of The Sun today being praised by The Sun for saying that a woman is a woman and being built up as this kind of modern day British hero who's defending, you know, women and girls, you can see how quickly people can be won back by the establishment. You know, it's disappointing. Yeah. Anyway, Musket Basket gave $20. Thank you so much. Oh, no, we just read that. Sorry, I was repeating myself. Four Camera, I give $3. Thank you so much. And he said, Mark, since Gab UK has gone down, I can't find anywhere to access your daily news feed. Telegram desktop is glitchy and mobile version of lots of other user posts. Where to find your daily news feed? Look, I need to get back on to Gab. I've been a bit slack in doing that, and I need to get a VPN on my mobile device so I can post there. I'll get that done, and I'll take that feedback. I've been a bit slack, and I need to improve my game. Sorry about that if you've been missing out on me, and I will endeavour from tomorrow onwards to be better for you. Thank you for the $3, my friend. Bob Ross gave $20. Thank you so much. Said Goy Boy 1488 here. Just wanted to thank you both for what you do and ask Morgoth if a stream with Devon Stack is still in the works or not.
Hopefully it's something that we should have done years ago. I think he's great. We just never really got around to it. We're both in our own little bubbles in a way. But now with the online harms bill coming, I actually think I might have to get a move on and do that sooner rather than later. I may be waving goodbye to Devon for if it carries on with this rate of censorship.
Well, Devon's one of those people that I really love and I really get on with as well. Like behind the scenes, me and him, like if he ever messages me, it's always really interesting stuff. And I do really enjoy talking to him. I really enjoy talking to Morgoth, but I think it is sad because it does put that blockade between you and, you know, people you have a very warm association with overseas. You know, it's very disappointing. Aunt Sally gave $5. Thank you so much. So thank you, Mark. I love it when Morgoth is on. So do I. Hoyt gave $50 and said donation. Well, thank you so much for your generosity, my friend. VM gave $3. Thank you so much. Said, love me, Morgoth. Happy St. George's Day to both of you. Well, thank you so much. It Was Made Up gave $15. Thank you so much. Said, it's always good to hear from Morgoth. Thanks for all the great shows, Mark. Well, thank you so much. Mr. Monterey Burns gave $3. Thank you so much. Said, 108 years ago, the phrase was coined. If voting changed anything, they'd make it illegal. Time to try something new, as you said, community building and asset sharing. Well, thank you for the super chat. And yeah, I think that there's plenty of ways that we can reorientate our lives so we're not so dependent on the system. And I think, you know, Morgoth talked earlier about growing tomatoes. Okay. And I'm not going to sit here and saying growing tomatoes are a revolutionary act. But in a world where the government want you to own less and less and be more dependent on the system, doing things like growing a few vegetables or, you know, being a little bit more self-reliant is actually a pathway towards, in your own small way, breaking away from the system. And I think the more we're less reliant on the system, the stronger we are. I don't know if you want to comment on that, Morgoth.
I don't pretend that I'll ever be self-sufficient or anything, but I think it's good for your mental health. I think you're getting out there, you're getting your fingers dirty, even if you've just, I mean, I've just got raised beds, a few raised beds, and it's a wonderful thing because you start paying attention to nature and the weather and the seasons more, and you find ways to try and game the seasons. One of the reasons why I'm having a hard time with the tomatoes is that technically I planted them too early, which meant that they can't take low temperatures. And so I was having to mollycoddle them and put them on heating mats and move them towards the sun all of the time, all this kind of thing. And it makes you think about, you know, the seasons and nature in ways that I hadn't before. And I've been into that kind of thing and fishing stuff for years. And I think it's you're not behind screens, you're not scrolling your phones. It's just good for your mental health, I would say. Especially, you know, it keeps you literally grounded. So, yeah, I'm a big fan of that kind of thing.
Do you know what as well? I'll tell a really crap story now. But when we moved into the house that we live in now, I totally neglected the back garden and it got so overgrown. It was like a jungle. It was actually embarrassing. And the wife was having a go at me and I didn't really listen to her moaning. And I should have done. I should have respected her more, to be honest, and listened to her moaning. And it took a neighbour to lean out of the window and laugh at me and say, "Are you lost in the jungle out there, mate? You've got the worst lawn on the street." And this enraged me. I was absolutely enraged and embarrassed. And I bought some tools. I cut down every bit of grass. I ripped it up. It was down to brown roots. I tore up where it had fallen over. And in some places, it was literally back down to the dirt because the long grass had just flopped over, killed everything underneath it. It was like a comb over, basically. You know when like a bald guy's got a tiny little bit of hair at the side and combs it over? That's what happened with the grass. You know, it was all bald underneath, just these big long bits that were flopping over. Cut it all back and the garden looked like it had been shelled. It was an absolute mess. I bought a little bit of compost, mixed it with topsoil, gently put it over everywhere and reseeded almost every part of the garden. And the pride I felt when one morning I woke up and looked out of the window and I was like, "What's that sparkling on the grass?" And I put my glasses on and it was tiny, little bright green shoots just all over the garden. Mm. And as the grass came up and it looked beautiful and it finally was long enough and thick enough to do its first mow, I remember seeing my neighbour and he said, bloody hell, he said, you put me to shame now. My garden looks terrible compared to yours. And I felt such a sense of pride doing that, that, you know, well, I just loved it. My missus actually hated me for sorting out the garden because she's heard that story at least 200 times. And I'm sure she's just sort of one telling of that story away from stabbing me to death. But yeah, I did.
I mean, it's a bit like when people used to laugh at Jordan Peterson when he said that you're going to make your bed or whatever. And but there is something to that when you sit back and you can look at a sense of achievement. It's good. It's good for your well-being. It's good for your mental health.
It really is. And when you're growing something, I tell you, when you've got small children, the magic in their eyes when they're picking peas with you or pulling beetroots or they're cutting the courgettes and carrying them into mummy. There is a lot to be said for growing something with your children, even if it's just flowers or a few herbs. You know, I'm not saying everyone needs a garden, but even if you've got a little herb garden on the windowsill, kids love that, and I had some great times with my daughter doing that. So yeah, good times, except for the wife who hates hearing that story, because I'm not any overtold it, but I'm sure that the story becomes more boastful and grandiose every time I tell it, which I think is like salt in the wound as far as she's concerned. Rhodesian Ridgeback gave $3. Thank you so much. Said, Mark, happy St. George's Day from a Scotsman. Have you heard of these stories from Scotland of foreigners filming kids at play parks? Is this happening down south? What's going on with this? I get sent a huge amount of stories from Facebook of people saying that that's going on. I get sent stories of people saying don't go in certain parks because people are turning up and speaking to kids, offering them bags of sweets, trying to get them in cars and vans. But I rarely post them unless there's video evidence, because you can imagine that if just one of those stories is provably false, I would be in big trouble for sharing it. But I will say the amount I get told about this is worrying. I don't know if you've seen these stories, Morgoth, but I think it is concerning.
I have seen stories pop up like that. I couldn't say where they were, but I have, what do they call it, milling about, certain groups milling about where they shouldn't be. Again, you've got to be careful, because these, especially like on Twitter or whatever, where it's incentivized, where, and it could be a video from 5 years ago and this kind of thing. But if people are on the ground reporting it on Facebook, yeah, that wouldn't surprise me at all. It's bleak out there.
It is. And as a parent, it's very difficult when you're in public places, because everybody has a phone and everybody holds their phone up sort of like I've just done. And it allows the camera module is naturally pointed in front of them, and you don't know what they're filming or if they are filming. They've just got the camera there. Now, there's the other thing, you know, when you're out, you do take pictures of your children. If you're at a play park or an activity center, naturally, sometimes other children get in the frame and you accidentally end up with a picture of your child, you know, beaming, smiling, climbing up a climbing frame, coming down a slide, but with another child sort of just in the corner of the shot, which is also awkward. But it is one of those things where it's hard to confront people, because it's not like the old days where somebody would have to walk around with a video camera. Everyone now has the ability to buy a device where they can record in 4K at 60 frames a second. And that is something which unfortunately allows people who are very creepy to do these things. So it is difficult, but I don't always report on these things, because if I do, I am concerned that all I need is to be tricked by one person who sends one very disingenuous article. And that gets me into trouble, because that's what the state are looking for. British Gammon gave $25. Thank you so much. She said, I'm planning to spoil my ballot paper in next week's local elections. Would you advise people to do this? And if so, what would you suggest people write on the ballot paper? Well, I've got two pieces of advice. First, I'd say thank you to you for your super chat and for your continued support. And thank you for being one of the people who's jumped over and helped me out by coming to Entropy. I spoil my ballot paper, but I've got to say this to people. If you've got a reform candidate, and if you think that reform candidate can unseat a Conservative or Labour sitting politician, I would say it's down to you and your conscience. And I won't judge any, like, if somebody comes up to me and said they voted Labour, Conservative or Lib Dem or the Green Party, you know, I'll give them what for. But if somebody comes up to me and says, look, Mark, I either spoiled my ballot paper or I voted for reform because I thought we could unseat this horrible Labour politician that pushes diversity and the green agenda and, you know, carbon neutral crap and all of that, I would be completely understanding of people voting that way. If you're going to spoil the ballot paper, write something powerful like, you know, none of them were worth voting for, or, you know, close the border. Say something that you believe in, and, you know, it does register as a protest. But I can understand why some people will be voting reform. And if you have a particularly hated sitting politician, you can get them out. You know, that is a way to send a message too. What do you think, Morgoth? Would you consider voting reform to unseat a particularly odious Tory or Labour politician?
Yeah, my stance is always to try and destroy the Tory party. But as far as sort of spoiling the ballot, I've never really understood that. Like, does it register with anything? Like, does it matter?
Yeah, it does. Basically, when the votes are counted, you will see percentages that the main parties take in the election. But usually those percentages, if you go down to sort of a tenth or a hundredth of a percent, never add up to 100. And that's because there are spoiled ballots. And recently there have been some elections where significant numbers of people have spoiled their ballots. So the total of other parties has added up to something like maybe 90%, 85%, with 10 to 15% spoiled ballots. So if you got enough people to spoil your ballots, you could actually end up in a situation where spoiled ballots won the election. And that would show that there are significant people, significant numbers of people willing to come out to vote, but they all feel there isn't a worthy option on the ballot paper. So it's better, basically, it's better to spoil your ballot paper than it is to stay at home. And, you know, and I can understand why some people would argue that it's better to have a reform councillor or a reform county councillor than it is to have a Labour or Tory county councillor.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I was in the BNP, it would sometimes be slightly frustrating if you had a few spoiled ballots and like a candidate was kind of like 10 votes off winning. And you're like, oh, God, if only those people who were protesting by a spoiled ballot protested by voting BNP, you know. So, yeah, it can cut both ways. Jagdeep Jaino gave $10. Thank you so much. He said, hey, Morgoth, be honest. Would Irish nationalist Keith Woods go down in your estimation if it emerged that he had deeply fallen in love with a bogged American sex worker prostitute who previously dated rappers and sent her long voice notes detailing his innermost feelings and undying infatuation? You ask this question to every guest, Jagdeep. You ask it to every guest. Morgoth, you don't obviously have to answer because it's a drama question.
Yeah, I'd prefer not to answer. As far as people can do stupid things, I'm not aware of any of those details, so I don't really have a comment on it.
I'll say this, as a red-blooded male, and as a red-blooded male who quite notoriously has dated women who are extremely attractive but also tattooed hot messes, sometimes that fruit is dangling there from the tree and part of you just wants to pick it and take a big bite. And sometimes you take a big bite and it tastes great at the time, but gives you stomach ache shortly afterwards. I've gone down that road, and I can tell you, it's really fun at the time, but you will wake up with stomach cramps, metaphorically speaking. So I'm definitely not going to castigate Keith for dating, you know, or attempting to, or talking to an attractive tattooed lady. Although I will say the girl I dated that was tattooed was more attractive than the one that Keith was chatting up. So, yeah. You know, not to say I'm the better man, but only joking, Keith, only joking. Please still come on the show because you are now very influential. He's probably never going to come on the show again after I've made that joke, is he? Well done, Jagdeep. You've made an enemy of Keith. Jagdeep gave another $10. Thank you so much. He said, hey, Mark and Morgoth, what are your thoughts on the fiery, defiant patriots Steve Laws and Zuma Historian leaving the Homeland Party after Big Kenny appointed a race fetishist femboy as branch organiser in Northern Ireland? And do you think that British nationalists should involve themselves in Ireland? Well, we'll deal with those two questions separately. And I'll start by saying I could use this as a platform to attack the talentless, morbidly obese slob who looks like he's one chip butty away from a triple heart bypass. But as much as I'd like to do that, and as much as it does need to be done, as much as he deserves to be publicly mocked, not least for his disgusting physical appearance, like a melted blob of ice cream on a summer's day. Also, you know, if you're that fat, here's a little tip, right? Every time you speak to the camera, just do head and shoulders. No one wants to see your disgusting belly hanging over your genitals. It's foul. Lose some weight, you pig. Anyway, now I've got that off my chest. That's me being pleasant, because I could go a lot harder. I'll say this. Steve Laws and I used to get on very well. I've not spoken to him for a while. I don't know whether he likes me anymore. But there's one thing you have to say about Steve Laws. Is Steve Laws is very, very down the line. He's a straight-talking, principled guy that stands by what he believes. He wants a near enough 100% ethnically homogenised British Isles. He wants England for the English, Scottish, Scotland for the Scots, etc., etc. And he stands by that. And the fact that him and Zuma Historian walked away when what I predicted came true, and I'm not going to turn this into an I told you so party, but what I predicted did come true. I said a good couple of weeks ago, was it a couple of weeks ago, a couple of months ago? Somebody can dig it out and clip it if they want. But I said a while back that the Homeland Party was going to cause two things to happen. I said they would rapidly sell out to gain votes, and they would leave young nationalists in one of two horrible positions. They'd present young nationalists with a terrible predicament. The first is that these young nationalists would de-radicalise, stop talking about Israeli power and Zionist power. They would start selling out on the issue of remigration, and that they would accept all manner of liberal ills on this road to hell where you sell out hoping that one day you'll sell out so far that they give you a tiny bit of power. So that was my first prediction, that young nationalists would be forced to go down this de-radicalization, Toryfied, Reform 2.0 route. Or I said they'd be forced out of the organization. And I was 100% right. I said this would happen. I knew it would happen. You could see the writing was on the wall. But Steve Laws is a principled fella, and he pushed back. But one thing I will say is that when Kenny was in my organization, he kept going on about vetting. He kept going on about appointing the right people to positions. He knocked people back for living with their mum. He knocked people back because a bloke's girlfriend wasn't fully on board with everything we believed in. Him and his little freaky friend, Aunt Burrows, stopped a guy from joining because he lived in a caravan. They had a laundry list of reasons why people weren't good enough to assume the role of regional organizer, branch organizer, or even local fitness officer. It was strange how desperate they were to keep the organization strong and pure. So it did actually come as a shock to me. Not many things come as a big shock to me. But when I saw a homosexual cross-dressing cat boy with a preference for black men being appointed as the Northern Ireland regional organizer, even I was shocked. And I was appalled. And I think the fact that they are now forcing out leaders of that organization for speaking out against that is very suspicious. But this isn't a one-off. It comes on the back of the acceptance of Zionism and the watering down of racial policy. And it was only about 3 weeks ago when the morbidly obese slob appeared on a show with another fat guy, and he stated that all you need to do to become British is marry somebody who's a British citizen, and then you become part of the family. I was taken back and appalled, and I'm sure Steve Laws was appalled, because not only have they embraced Zionism, not only have they sold out on what actually is ethno-nationalism, but now they're embracing this bizarre homosexual fetishism. They've got an organizer from a group called the LGB Alliance. They've changed their party policy to read that their traditional values policy protects lesbian and gay spaces, because apparently they're under threat. And this is how a party comes, you know, sets out as being a principled racial nationalist movement that stands for traditional values, and ends up becoming nothing than Reform 2.0 in a couple of years, in the desperate pursuit of votes. But what's the point? To me, it's a waste of time, and it's a grift, and it's a betrayal of people who thought they were getting a hardline principled nationalist party like the BNP used to be. And I'll say this. This is what the system does. And I've spoken about this many times. The system corrupts, it twists, it co-opts. And people who enter the system with the belief that they're going to change the system usually end up being changed by the system. And the warning signs were there about a year or so ago. One of their little community councillors in Scotland, who aren't paid or are completely unelected, they just do it in their own free time like a local busybody. That guy voted for diversity and inclusion on some tin pot community council just to stay in with the other local busybodies. This is a betrayal. It's not nationalism. And Steve must have been sick of this, because you want my take? I'll give it to you. They used Steve. That party was going nowhere. No one was attracted to it until Steve got on board. He built it up with his large audience, with his hardline rhetoric. He got young people involved. And then when they had enough new members off his back and off his hard work, they shafted him. I feel awful for him. I'm not going to condescend him. I'm not expecting him to come on PWR. But I will say this to him. Steve, you've proved yourself to be a principled guy. And if you are going to re-enter politics, you should set up your own thing, and you should stand upon the principles that you hold dear. And my final point is, why the hell would you appoint some cross-dressing catboy weirdo in Northern Ireland of all places? My question for you, Morgoth, is, are you a cross-dressing catboy fan? Is that what you do you like that? Is that your thing?
Yeah, I don't get that either. Like, my sort of take, I'm very much outside of all of this. I'm also realize I'm walking on eggshells. I don't want to get dragged into a load of issues. But how did that actually happen? How did they end up with a femboy catboy running the...
Well, I'll tell you. Kenny released a statement. The slob released a statement saying that he was a great guy. They vetted him. He passed the vetting. They knew about his history, and they appointed him because he was a good guy, the perfect pick for the job. And apparently anyone out there who says he's not suitable as a regional organizer, well, those people are terminally online cranks or bad actors. So I'm sorry, Morgoth. What are you, a terminally online crank or a bad actor?
Yeah, and so I don't have much to say on it, but I've got questions. So then my understanding is Steve Laws and Zuma Historian objected to what had happened with Northern Ireland, and then they were shown the door. essentially.
Yeah, they were forced out. They Zuma historian was called to an emergency meeting where he was accused of plotting against the slob and thrown out. There was other people who were on the National Council who were accused of plotting and were thrown out. And this is all from this slob. And the slob used to criticise Nick Griffin and say, oh, we want a democratic, open and transparent political organisation, not like Nick Griffin had. To vote Nick Griffin out, you needed 66% of the advisory council to agree. And Nick Griffin appoints the advisory council. Well, to get rid of the slob as leader, you need 75% of the National Council to vote against him. He appoints the National Council and has just booted a load of people off it who were concerned that a cat boy wasn't the best thing for a nationalist party. It's madness.
So I saw the all I really saw was the statements that the different people involved gave on Twitter, and I very much just sort of watched that, And what the Homeland Party response was that Steve Laws was going too hard line, and they were it was more pure deport everybody and these positions which the Homeland Party didn't want. They didn't view that as sensible nationalism. And all I mean is, like, is that not fair comment on the people who run the party? I'm just trying to be objective. Because if they have a clear set of principles and policies, and then somebody is running against that or trying to change that, is there not a tension there? I'm just trying to be, you know, on the fence objective.
No, you are being objective. Look, everyone knows what Steve Laws is. Steve Laws is the man who campaigns against mass immigration. He goes to Dover, he talks about immigration, and he is the re-migration man. And Steve Laws is fully behind that. Now, he believes remigration is inevitable. I absolutely want remigration to happen, but I don't think it's inevitable. I think we're in a much darker situation than Steve does. He's more of an optimist than me. But I think that this National Council, run by the morbidly obese slob, is basically a sellout group, a clique of sellouts who are basically said, ethno-nationalism, we're going to set that to one side to try and create some kind of Zio sellout party. And the Zionism issue is another big issue. You can't have policy makers in a British nationalist party giving their undying support to Israel and stating that Israel has the right to ethnically cleanse Gaza. You can't serve two masters. And if you are in the pay of the State of Israel, that is a direct contradiction with British interests. So, yeah, I agree with you. What I'm saying is they have sold out on the ethno-nationalist issue. They've embraced this sort of homosexual lobby. They've embraced the Zionist influencers. And it's almost like they're trying to recreate Anne-Marie's For Britain, but with a markedly less attractive leader.
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough. As I say, I'm on the outside looking in on all of this. I don't have any insights or anything.
But if you were on the outside looking in and you saw a semi-naked skinny boy with cat ears dressed in women's underwear dancing, would you want to be on the inside?
Yeah, that's an immediate red flag. Look, I've tried to be as objective as I can here, but there's no dressing that up. Excuse the pun. There's no getting around that. There's not really any way. I think something like that would be too much for even like the Tory party.
I do. And I'll say this. You know, David Clues was right about this as well. David Clues, you know, they've invited this Raymond Camus from France to come and speak at some conference. And the guy is a homosexual Zionist. And when the guy got banned from coming into Britain, David Clues was about the only person who had the balls to stand up to the slob. And he came out and said, yeah, we want him being banned from coming into Britain. Why would we want a homosexual Zionist coming into Britain to push that agenda on young nationalist men? Why would we want that? David Clues, UNN. You know, he said the guy's a staunch Christian. but he's got a point. So I think that pretty much wraps it up on that particular topic, unless you want to add anything more, Morgoth, which I don't think you do.
No, that's I don't have much input on that.
Except for you clearly don't like Catboys or Zionists.
No, I don't like either one of those, no.
Good, so it's not the party for you. The Thin Red Line gave $25, thank you so much. And he said, always great to hear from Morgoth indeed. VM gave $3, thank you so much. He said, Morgoth may have done hate reading The Guardian, but would you ever do hate watching two-hour-long BreadTube videos?
I don't know. I think BreadTube's kind of died a death. It doesn't seem to be much of a thing anymore. I think a lot of them packed up. Most of them became trans. I don't think it's the force of like what it was back in the day. Back in the kind of, I would say, the Trump's first term and then into the Biden term, the BreadTube thing was huge. But they seem to have run out of steam. I think the left across the board is absolutely dilapidated and exhausted. Where I think the interesting discussions are happening now, or in terms of long-form podcasts and whatnot, or the Joe Rogan, Douglas Murray, the Zio Shill containment mechanisms kicking in. There's a lot of interesting things going on with that, which you know we could get into another time. I think that's where the kind of the meat is in sort of cultural and ideological battles and whatnot.
Yeah, I agree. Although I will say this, Joe Rogan and his podcast is often interesting, but sometimes, he does push a few things that have me rolling my eyes too. And I'm not a big fan of his sort of like, yeah, let's all smoke weed together kind of nonsense. But I do think that's where the political discourse has shifted to. And it is the most watched podcast in the world. But I will say this, when he presents debates or arguments, he seems to choreograph them in a very careful way to make sure that the right side doesn't come out and win. So recently he had the odious Douglas Murray arguing for why Palestine never existed and should be like blown to pieces by Israel. But the person he had arguing against Murray was clearly not as well educated and not as good at debating. Now, if he'd have had somebody on there like David Duke or Kevin MacDonald or somebody who actually is a real force to be reckoned with. Even somebody like Ron Unz, he could have actually had a Duke. We had Ron Unz on this show. Ron Unz is amazing. The guy's just an incredible speaker. If he'd had Ron Unz on and Ron Unz had gone up against Douglas Murray would have been chewed up and spat out and made to look like a total tit. But Rogan always has a way of presenting the argument for good with the least able advocate, and I don't know if you've noticed that, but I find it frustrating.
I have, but I think it started off with, there was somebody called Marty Maid, he is on Twitter, and he's been doing kind of not quite David Irving standard, but he's doing a bit of World War II revisionism. And he went on, and he's been getting platformed by Tucker Carlson as well. Now, this drove people like Douglas Murray and Jordan Peterson wild. And a lot of the discussion was around whether Churchill was responsible for World War II, whether he was a false hero and this kind of thing. And I saw a clip from Murray yesterday. And what he said was actually, what he let slip was that it's not really about Winston Churchill. That's not what this, because they're now lining up and they're now, this whole podcast tours going on with Sam Harris. They're all jumping on board as if Joe Rogan needs to be controlled. This is getting out of hand. But what they're really scared about is that people are questioning, poking around in the kind of formation of the post-war morality, where Hitler is the devil and white guilt. And Murray actually said, this new right movement, which is spreading like wildfire, they have now come to the conclusion that they need to undo certain truths that were made in the post-World War II era. For example, that because of the Holocaust, Europeans had to be nice to minorities all of the time. So what fascinated me about that is that Douglas Murray, who's married to a Jewish man, is actually aware of the kind of psychological control mechanisms which have been embedded within the European mind. And he's actually come out and now arguing, saying that they have to stay there. You can't take that off. You can't take the calipers off yet. You can't unshackle yourself from that post-war mythos where European self-interest is associated with evil incarnate, which is kind of like embedded within the whole. It's why where white guilt comes from. It's why accusations like racism and being called a Nazi, all of this stuff. And what fascinated me was that Murray is now coming out on the side. When you clear away all the other stuff about Churchill and whatnot, this is it. This is what their problem is. And you get this sense that there was a meme that was going around about the woke right. So what they did was they kind of canned the woke left because they were coming out. They were too hostile to Israel. They were on the side of Palestinians and whatnot. And you began to see these big influencers dropping this term a few months ago called woke right. And now it becomes apparent what's going on there is that you've got this kind of influential network of people, big Twitter accounts, bloggers, podcasters and whatnot. And they have decided that the right is just the same as the left for the same reasons, that there's now anti-Semitism on the right and we have to tackle that as soon as we deal with the left. We have to tackle that over on the right immediately. And that's the current sort of battle that's going on. And it's as if sort of Joe Rogan's this big dummy who doesn't quite grasp the terrain that he stumbled into. He's got this kind of Gen X, 90s, yeah, whatever floats your boat, man. We'll just have the conversations. Now all of these influential people are lining up and saying, yeah, you have to get a grip. You don't understand what you're playing with here. And so this is the kind of interesting dynamic that I see happening at the moment.
Yeah, that's an interesting take. I will say, and I've said this, it's something which probably hasn't won me any friends in the long term, and has probably been something that's got me deplatformed from many places. But unless the narrative around World War II does get the questioning it deserves and does largely collapse, I do always think we will be held back. And there's lots of people say, no, 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 we don't need to go there. We don't need to approach that. But I fundamentally think we do to a large degree. And we do because it is the founding mythos of the modern age. The founding mythos of the modern age is that British soldiers willingly and enthusiastically went to fight against racism, fascism, homophobia to build a rainbow society. And that, you know, the mustached man and Germany were the big evils, that if they'd have won, we wouldn't live in this vibrant, beautiful utopia. And that foundational myth is something that holds people back from embracing what we need, which is an ethnocentric society. I wrote this in my book, and I do think it needs challenging. I'm happy that people are challenging it. And I would love to see, you know, a greater focus, you know, on sort of debates between people who could debate this to the degree it needs debating. And I am happy this is finally getting to the mainstream, but I feel a bit sort of, one thing I do feel a bit annoyed about is that, you know, I have been so heavily deplatformed, my, you know, ability to earn money has been completely destroyed, you know, and I've really suffered for being one of the people that pushed this issue before bigger names jumped on it. And I've you know, sadly, that's where I am.
Yeah, you have suffered for it, like Mark, I'll give you that.
But that's what happens. You either stick to your guns and you suffer, or you sell out and then you probably suffer in another way. And I've got to say this, you know, at least I have a clear conscience. Because I tell you what, the internal suffering of being a sellout must be much worse. The resident baker gave $5. Thank you so much. It's great to see Morgoth back on. Mark, has he had any recent run-ins with lefty barmaids recently? Also, any chance of a Guardian hate read anytime soon?
I haven't. The last time I heard about that barmaid, that's an old story. She'd been shipped off. She was like in Blythe or something, where she wouldn't be in that bougie little pretentious real ale pub where I was, microbrewery pub. She'll be up there with the lads, filling their Fosters now, so that's fair enough. As for hate reading The Guardian, I just can't do it anymore because I'd be banned or go to jail or whatever. And I felt like I was putting on a bit of a performance after five or six of them as well, so I doubt it.
Yeah, I think some things do run their course, but like everything that runs their course, there's always like a reunion tour eventually. So maybe he could come back for a one-off. A Scaredy Cat gave $8. Thanks so much. Said, hi, Morgoth and Mark. Best wishes. Well, thank you so much, my dear. It's always good to have you here. Spartan Sadukar gave $1. Thank you so much. Said, evil people creating technological slavery is a very serious threat. There are now computers with biological parts. Thinking machines might steal humanity's place as the apex predator. I think that's pretty much undeniable. Fancy Pants and MP5s gave $5. Thank you so much. The Coin Clippers have full internet control now. And JDev Kumar gave $10. Well, thank you so much, guys, for those final Super Chats. And that takes us neatly to the end of the Super Chats and the end of the show. I'd just like to say, if you're watching on replay and you want to donate, you can do via clicking the Entropy link. I do take donations, or you have the ability to take donations when I'm offline. So if you want to donate that way, please consider doing so. And I'd just like to say thanks for being with me, Morgoth. It's, as always, a really entertaining show, and the last 2 hours have just flown by. Would you like the final say, my friend?
Well, thanks for having us on again. I've got a new article up on the Substack I posted yesterday. I did a video last week. And this week on Endeavor's channel, we'll be doing classic movies, and we're talking about Once Upon a Time in America, which, you know, given that group we were talking about, it's going to be difficult to touch that issue, where it's like the big Jewish gangster movie and how they're portrayed, which isn't particularly nice, which is why I'd probably never heard of it for most of my life. But, yeah.
Do you know a really interesting factoid? If you actually look at the way the mafia changed in America, originally it was Italian, and originally it was mainly Sicilian. And when they came to America, they actually had really, really strict rules about who could become a made man, who could become part of the mafia. And the original mafia bosses, the original leaders that were 100% Italian, were actually turned against each other by Jewish gangsters, who created a war between the leading Italian gangsters, who depleted each other's power. And as they did so, both ended up being removed one after the other. And the upshoot of that was, it opened up a more multicultural mafia that involved a large number of Jewish gangsters, who then took over a large part of what was the traditional Italian mafia stomping grounds. So if you look at the way that the Jewish mafia entered organized crime, it was by deception, and it was by turning Italians against each other and having them remove each other from positions of power to the benefit of the Jewish gangsters.
In-group buy-ins and networking is the undefeated formula for political power, or criminal power in this case.
Indeed. Anyway, that brings us to a beautiful end for the show. Thank you so much, Morgoth, for being here. I would just like to say a massive thank you to everyone who donated so generously. Thank you to all those who moved over to Entropy. And as I said, if you want to donate by other means, you can donate when I'm offline or via cryptocurrency. And the biggest thank you as ever goes to the incredible people who support this show week in, week out. Peak viewers, we had over 600 people watching live tonight, which is a nice number. And you can catch out with the replays over on Odyssey, Rumble and BitChute. Thank you so much to everyone. Thank you to Morgoth. Thank you to the donors. And thank you to everyone who joined in any way. I'll see you same time next week for another episode of Patriotic Weekly Review. Thank you and good night. Love you all and see you again soon.